Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we take a voyage around the world in search of extraordinary and exotic flavors. We head north to the land of the midnight sun and explore Nordic culinary traditions with Chef Magnus Nielsen.
You can just imagine the difference from southeastern parts of Finland, which borders on Russia, and then Greenland in the west.
And then we'll return south to learn about the vegan possibilities within the foodways of the African diaspora with cookbook author and activist Bryant Terry.
So much of what has influenced me more than anything in my approach to cooking is Louisiana cooking, because I really see southern cooking as the original modern global fusion cuisine.
Bring along your fork for a taste of the world on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shannon Van Sant. A chartered train carrying congressional Republicans to an annual party conference in West Virginia has hit a garbage truck on the tracks. Amtrak has confirmed that no one on the train was killed, but outside of the train, there was one fatality, and a second person was transported to the hospital with serious injuries. The White House says there are no serious injuries among members of Congress or their staff. NPR's Brackton Booker reports.
In a statement, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders says President Trump has been briefed on the situation, and senior administration officials are in contact with Amtrak and state and local authorities. The train was transporting lawmakers to their annual retreat at the Greenbrier Resort in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. The crash took place in the city of Crozet, Virginia, about a 20-minute drive west of Charlottesville. Dozens of GOP lawmakers were aboard the train, including House Speaker Paul Ryan. GOP aides tell NPR Ryan was not injured in the crash. Brackton Booker, NPR News.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency now says it is not ending its distributions of food and water on the island of Puerto Rico, at least not yet. The agency had originally said it planned to do that as of January 31st. NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
A spokesman for FEMA says the agency made a mistake when it told NPR that its distributions on the island would end on the 31st and that it would turn its remaining supplies over to the Puerto Rican government to distribute. While the agency says it still plans to do that at some point, the details haven't been finalized. The reversal came after lawmakers from both political parties reacted angrily to news of the agency's plan. Democratic Florida Senator Bill Nelson says many people on the island are still without power. FEMA says communities in Puerto Rico that need food and water supplies can continue to get them from several warehouses on the island. Adrian Florido, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Fed Chair Janet Yellen has presided over her last monetary policy meeting. Yellen will step down from the post she has held for 4 years on Saturday. Fed policymakers wrapped up a two-day meeting in Washington, voting to keep a benchmark interest rate unchanged. The target for the Fed funds rate remains in a range between 1.25% and 1.5%. The director of the FBI is condemning House Republicans for releasing a secret memo that they say shows improper surveillance on a former Trump campaign advisor. President Trump says he supports the release of the memo. Director Christopher Wray says the FBI has grave concerns about omissions of fact that fundamentally impact the memo's accuracy. Wray was reportedly allowed to review the memo on Sunday. The White House says a legal and national security check of the memo will happen before its release. South Carolina GOP Congressman Trey Gowdy, chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, has announced he is not seeking re-election this year. This is NPR News. Retailer Steinhoff has reported its former CEO to anti-corruption police in South Africa. As Peter Granitz reports from Pretoria, South African regulators are also investigating the company for financial crimes.
Steinhoff owns dozens of household goods and clothing companies around the world, including the Mattress Firm franchise in the United States. It's headquartered in South Africa. Late last year, the company disclosed financial irregularities, and since then, its share price has tanked, losing tens of billions of dollars in value. Steinhoff's acting chair, Heather Sahn, told a parliamentary committee in Cape Town that the company filed charges against its former CEO, Marcus Usta. Usta resigned in December. South Africa's corporate regulator has given the board of directors 6 months to identify anyone who was involved in the irregularities or face criminal penalties themselves. For NPR News, I'm Peter Granitz in Pretoria.
Google says it's tweaking its search results to provide more diverse perspectives. The change will impact the box text called snippets that appear at the top of search results pages. The snippets are placed below the paid listings and provide quick information and data to users. Google says it has provided just a single box in the past, but says now it will show multiple snippets. Hong Kong is banning all ivory sales by 2021. Elephant tusk, ivory statues, carvings, and chopsticks are still sold in many antique stores in the city. The new ban closes a major loophole in activist efforts to protect elephants from poaching. China is a major center of demand for ivory. I'm Shannon Van Sant, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Howdy, partners. This is Ronella Rose Champagne, your host of Lost in Love. I hope you'll join me as we embark on our new time slot of Tuesdays at 1 p.m. right here on KRVS 88.7 FM in Lafayette and Lake Charles. Let's have some fun, y'all.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Food is one of the most accessible ways to learn about other cultures, and the best place for learning that I can think of is at the table. On this week's show, we're taking a voyage around the world in search of extraordinary and exotic flavors. We begin with cookbook author and food justice advocate Bryant Terry, who explains the process of transforming the soul food of his ancestors, applying vegan sensibilities while staying true to his roots. Then, we head to the land of the midnight sun, where winters are spent in darkness with frigid temperatures that defy our imagination. Extreme ingenuity has always been required for man to survive there. If it's edible, they'll eat it. At his famed restaurant, Faviken, Swedish chef Magnus Nilsson showcases the region's diversity using locally foraged and preserved foods totally foreign to our palates. Then, we get personal with one of my favorite superstars. James Beard award-winning Chicago chef Rick Bayless is the owner of several authentic yet trend-setting Mexican restaurants and hosts his own public television series, Mexico, One Plate at a Time. Bring along your fork for a taste of the world on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Bryant Terry. I am a chef, a food justice activist, and an author living in Oakland, California. I'm very happy to be back in New Orleans where I went to college and happy to be talking to Poppy.
For cookbook author and food justice activist Bryant Terry, getting people excited about healthy food has been an inspiration for much of his work. Author of Vegan Soul Food, The Inspired Vegan, and Afro-Vegan, Bryant is working on carving out new ways to create equitable access to fresh, healthy foods while staying true to the roots of Southern foodways traditions. We sat down to talk about how he's transforming African, Caribbean, and traditional soul food in ways that don't compromise his vegan sensibilities.
The food actually came out of my desire to create social change, and particularly thinking about changing food systems, changing the way that people are growing and consuming food. And part of it was living in New York. You know, at the time, I was actually a graduate student in history at NYU. And my research led me to some work that was being done in the late 60s and the 70s in the Bay Area by the Black Panthers. And they had this brilliant analysis that looked at the intersection of poverty, malnutrition, and institutional racism. And, you know, just understanding that poor people needed to be fed. So they had these grocery giveaway programs where they were giving away thousands of pounds of groceries to low-income residents of the Bay Area. But the program that moved me more than any was their free breakfast for children program. They simply fed young people breakfast every day before going to school. And within 1 year, they replicated it in cities across the country. And they were feeding over 10,000 young people every single day. And I was so moved by that because around 2001, I started thinking about food issues more seriously, going to conferences. And I had read this book, Food Politics. And just reading and learning about the immense influence that the food and beverage industry has on the consumption patterns of all of us, but particularly the way they target children, sometimes starting as young as 2 years old, and, you know, the kind of exponential rise that we've seen in preventable diet-related illnesses, and just the fact that this generation of young people is at risk for having a shorter lifespan than their parents' generation. And I really felt like I needed to do something. And that's kind of how I launched into my food activism, which eventually evolved into my cookbook writing.
That's fantastic. And are you a vegan full time?
So I currently don't eat any animal products, but I won't say I reject the term vegan. I choose not to label myself a vegan because I'm really about encouraging people to eat based on what their body needs, what their values might be, but not choosing a label and kind of following the script accordingly. I think that's where people get in trouble. The tricky thing is when you have your book published by a major corporation, as I do, oftentimes
10-Speed Press, you lucky guy. They're such a great imprint.
I love 10-Speed Press. And actually, the funny thing is, this was the first book that I was actually excited about having the word vegan in the title. My prior two books, Vegan Soul Kitchen and The Inspired Vegan, which was with another publisher, I didn't want vegan in the title because for me, the veganism was part of it. You know, I really am clear about this growing body of research that is showing that plant-centered diets can be effective in helping to prevent chronic illnesses or help to, you know, heal chronic illnesses. So I really want to have that as a tool for people who might be dealing with some health issues. But what has been most important to me is about getting people eating real food again. You know, not just the vegan and vegetarian food, but just Americans in general. We're eating far too much processed and packaged and just fake food.
Yeah.
So a large part of it is also just teaching people how to cook again, just giving them the basic rudimentary skills of how to take some food that's fresh, make it from scratch, and have a meal that's satisfying, that's delicious, and then looks good too.
Well, you did a really good job because all of your recipes are very approachable. And your particular approach has been to take the various African diasporas all across the world, Brazil, in the Caribbean, in the South. You take those various influences and you're kind of creating a new fusion. And I think you're doing it so smartly.
Thank you. Well, you know, the thing is, I'll say this, so much of, I guess, in terms of what has influenced me more than anything in my approach to cooking is Louisiana cooking. Because when we think about just the amalgam of, you know, the cuisines from Native Americans and Europeans and Africans kind of coming together and creating this whole new cuisine, because I really see Southern cooking as the original modern global fusion cuisine, if you want to look at it like that.
That's true.
And so originally, I was focusing a lot on African-American cuisine because, you know, African-American cuisine gets such a bad rap. You know, I think people, when they talk about soul food, most often in their minds is synonymous with African-American cuisine. This is what Black people eat. You know, the comfort foods, the deep-fried fatty meats, macaroni and cheese, like the things that traditionally people would have on holidays and celebrations. Or when people think about African-American cuisine, they're thinking about the kind of antebellum survival food, you know, the food in many in the kind of Black Belt states that were more paternalistic, the remnants of the plantation owners' tables. And, you know, I'm not trying to reject either of those, but I want people to understand the diversity and complexity of it and kind of, you know, unpeel the layers and get back to the roots, the foundation of it. And we're talking about things like black-eyed peas, sugar snap peas, pole beans, dandelion greens, collards, kale. Like, these are okra. Just like okra, you know, just like really healthful, delicious, simple, good food. And I want people to understand that that is as much of the foundation of the cuisine as any other thing, and to really complicate their understanding of it.
So you're not copying dishes that we normally find in the soul food category or the southern food category. You're doing new creations. So take one of your favorite dishes and walk me through how you approached this and how it all turns out.
Well, you know, one of my favorite recipes in here, I have to say, it's my blackened okra with red rice. I know a lot of people have an aversion to what they see as the sliminess of okra. And, you know, oftentimes when you're cooking in a stew or gumbo, it does have that gelatinous kind of texture that turns some people off. And I found that one way to make it more palatable for those type of people is grilling it or broiling it. You know, those are the ways that kind of ease in the okra haters. Uh-huh. And so with this recipe, you know, I suggest grilling it. But then I take this blackened seasoning, which, you know, comes from Cajun
Paul Prudhomme.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm coated in that, and then I serve it along with this kind of Coastal Carolina-inspired red rice. So being a child of the 90s, I'm definitely a hip-hop head. And so when just even thinking about, like, you know, hip-hop production and this kind of cutting and pasting and reworking and remixing different sounds and energies and bringing them together to create something new, that was an inspiration as well. So I like to think of it as, you know, jazz cooking, hip-hop, just all those elements kind of, like, inspire the way that I approach cooking.
One of the things I've never seen in a book before is, along with the typical how many servings a recipe gives you, you also give us the soundtrack and the book. So tell us about that, Bryant. Why does each recipe have a soundtrack and a book?
So I just grew up in a very musical household. You know, all my mom and her siblings, whenever we had family gatherings around food, there'd be people playing the piano, singing, and just like really bringing art and culture to the table. You know, what we've seen with this industrial food, where food has become such a commodity, it's almost like there's this huge chasm where food is on one side and art and community and culture is way over there. And I'm really trying to bridge those gaps and bring those things back together, because I think in terms of exciting people to work for something different, to move past this industrial food system, to really get back to just like local, seasonal, sustainable food, we can't start with the high-level public policy. You can't start with the heady intellectual ideas. You have to start with something that's visceral, that's emotional. And my guiding mantra has been, start with the visceral, move to the cerebral, and end at the political. Understanding that, you know, these food issues are political, and we need to look at public policies. But I like to start with the thing that everyone can relate to, the thing that brings everyone to the table, and that's like good food, conversation, music, art, culture, all those things. And I really try to express that in the books.
So you have a lot of very lofty goals with the work that you have set out to do in life. And this is your third book. What have you accomplished through your work that you're the proudest of?
I have to say, I need to think about it on the different levels. Because when I think about my work as an educator and an activist, I think one of the proudest moments for me was when I was working with kids in New York City, and one of the young women in our program, who was a young mother, she had a 2-year-old son. She was so committed to helping other young moms think about the issues that affect children, because she was so committed to, you know, feeding her own son healthy foods, that she started doing workshops for the young moms at the center that we were based at doing our project. And so just for me to have one of the people, the kids that I work with, come up with this idea and it be wildly successful, I think that is one of my high moments as an educator. As a cookbook writer, I would say the litmus test for the success of my recipes for me isn't really if my cool friends in Oakland or Brooklyn or Portland or New Orleans like the recipes, but like, do my older relatives in Arkansas and Mississippi and Tennessee, like, will they like them? And the reception that I've gotten from my family is really, it moves me. When you bring people delicious food, you know, that's what moves people. You could talk about the ethics and the environmental issues and the health, how healthy it is, but that doesn't move most people. You know what I mean? People like good food. And so I figure if you can do all those things, if you can give people delicious food that's also, you know, local, that's seasonal, that's sustainable, then that's when you've done a great job.
Bryant Terry, author of Afro-Vegan.
There's a music in the streets, there's a music in the air, a little old soul beat, there's dancing everywhere.
Coming up next, we speak with author and food columnist Kim Suni, whose book, A Mouthful of Stars, chronicles her travels around the world in search of a personal taste of home. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
Pardon me, but you could use it. We gonna make a little music. You got soul, don't you lose it. We gonna make a little music. Everything's gonna be mellow.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through KRVS program sponsorship. For more information, call 337-482-1437 and thank you.
Remember this unforgettable extended medley by fiddler Kevin Burke? We do this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
Decides if you qualify for a loan, or how about that job you applied for?
It's almost always algorithmic at this point.
But the thing is, algorithms aren't always fair.
That's what data science does, separate people into winners and losers. It's keeping people who are unlucky, unlucky. It's getting people who are lucky, more lucky.
I'm Guy Raz. Truth, Lies, and Statistics. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 8 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and also from Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From dock to pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. Author and food columnist Kim Suni was born in South Korea, but grew up in New Orleans after being adopted at a young age. Her best-selling memoir, Trail of Crumbs, Hunger, Love, and the Search for Home, tells stories of her quest to find identity through love, hunger, and food. In her subsequent book, A Mouthful of Stars, Kim continues this search for the flavors of home through recipes and poetry.
Writing is difficult, but I think I did it because it was a way to make sense of the world, or my world in particular. And I think because I was adopted and I don't really have any true records of who I am, that to actually put something in black and white, in print, it gives me my own history and it gives me a definition, not the defining thing about myself. But writing in general is a way to sort of distill moments, good and bad, or happy and joyful. And then cooking came along with that, because maybe cooking is the joyful side of sometimes writing can be a little bit more melancholy.
So somehow you found your poetry in food?
I think so. And recipes are like poems to me. And I think that's why in this book, A Mouthful of Stars, I wanted to include poetry.
How did that particular journey of discovery begin?
There was a Korean edition of my book, Trail of Crumbs, and the publisher invited me and I went back to Seoul. And I thought I was going there just to be an author and sign books and so forth. And once I got to Korea, there was this, just the media and publicity, and everyone all of a sudden decided they wanted to help me find my birth family. But I also met some other adoptees who were there. And so the journey turned very differently and unexpectedly, and it was pretty emotional.
There's a beautiful story about someone who thought maybe he was your brother.
Yes. I would get emails every once in a while from Koreans and saying, oh, I think you might be my daughter, or I think you might be my sister. And I don't know why, but I always ignored those. Not ignored them, but I didn't want to imagine that maybe, it was real. And then this one particular man really pursued it, and then I didn't hear from him for a while. But when I was there, he found out I was there, and he contacted the producer who was doing a documentary at the time about my journey. And their story made me understand that, I wasn't alone in this. They had lost their daughter and their sister when she was about 3 years old, about my age, in the same 1970s or so. And, we did the whole DNA test. That story's in the book. But I will remember that he came to the hotel the first time and brought a gift. And it was a beautiful Mont Blanc writing pen, because I am a writer. But he had the words "Missing You" engraved on the pen. And that alone was such a gift. But then he said, I know that all these years someone has been missing you. And so we ended up having this wonderful friendship, and the DNA tests came back, and it was, they were inconclusive. And so I will have to go back. But he said, no matter what, we can choose family and we can choose home.
And sometimes, those are the best family members, the ones you choose.
The ones we choose, exactly.
So you've been to Korea now multiple times. When you begin to eat Korean food for the first time, are there flavors that somehow trigger forgotten memories in your heart?
As a young child, after being adopted, I didn't want cookies or brownies and chocolate and milk and so forth after school. I wanted a bowl of steamed rice with a little pat of butter for several years. And then as I grew older and saw the other kids eating, American snacks, that's what I wanted. But so I think there's something about that came with me and that's inside of me. And then going back to Korea, no matter how difficult it was to feel Korean again or to feel accepted back into the country, I immediately would taste something. And I didn't have all these memories rushing back, but I really felt comfortable eating this food. And it made me feel welcome and grounded.
Does this begin to inform your personal cooking?
A little bit. When I was in Korea, actually, I bought Korean English cookbooks, grandmother cookbooks, just to kind of see. And I actually took some classes while I was there. But it's not something that I can go to easily and make quickly. Like I can throw together a pasta or jambalaya, something like that.
It's a lot more complicated.
It's complicated and it's more thoughtful. You have to really want to do it and think about it. More deliberate.
I have, followed your prose as you have written for periodicals, your work with Cottage Living, and you're renowned, award-winning for your prose. But I really didn't know about the poet in you. So in Mouthful of Stars, there's a poem that really touched my heart. And I was wondering if I could get you to read whatever feels the best to you. And tell us a little bit about it.
So this poem, you'll find the poem at the end of the Korea section. And I was with a poet, Lee Herrick, who's a poet from California. He was also adopted from Korea.
And he took that trip with you.
He took that trip with me. We met there, actually. And so we went through this whole search for birth families and so forth. And I was thinking about, you're always so conscious of what you're eating and what you're giving to someone else. And then I thought about what our birth mothers might have eaten and so forth, and how that that might have affected us. So I think that's what the poem is about. So it's in four sections. And the first one is called, If I Am What I Eat, Then I Am the Raw Jellied Crab, Oozing on the Tongue as We Sit in a Small Hot Room in Insadong, Where You, a Man I Have Known My Whole Life, Have Come to Take Pause in the Search of a Birth Mother. This is all we have, this crab, only this time of year, in this part of the world. Years ago, they warned eating it this way could cause temporary memory loss. But that smile on your face as you slurp the sea from one of the legs, and the heat of you, broad golden moon, eyes dark like hot stones. No one will ever know if those are tears or small birds in flight. Like the moments of our childhood, no one recorded, as if remembering would be too much. This temporary moment of forgetting is all we have, and somehow worth it all. 2. If you are what you eat, then you are the salted tomatoes and capers from climbing twisted vines in a town dusted with departure, and feverish kisses to the cheek, the neck, the underside of the palm, as a small boat awaits you. Let us share one last bowl of pasta, you suggest, with anchovy, hot pepper, a swipe of thick country bread drenched in bittersweet golden oil. If I am what you eat, I am the mother lode, the 200-year-old Istrian yeast for a biga, so sweet and swollen. A handful of golden raisins, saffron threads from a song I used to know by heart, a song I sing because I am what you are. If you are what I eat, then you will be a hot puffed donut filled with vanilla-flecked cream. I will be the moon rising and dusting the orchards with light and air, water and wind. Because if you are what I eat, then I will no longer eat fear, the way I used to, when I thought danger could slip into a bowl of noodles, like an unseen poison, like the hatred in countries, in the blackened hearts of people who know nothing of themselves. Because you are what I am, then I will be love and the memories of your childhood, and this is worth everything.
Oh, that is so beautiful, and I love the dichotomy between the two sides of that, because one seems to be clearly about your eastern side and the other addresses the western side of Kim Sinee.
I just realized that when I was reading it.
Well, thank you. Please come back and visit.
I will. Thank you, Poppy.
Kim Sinee, author of A Mouthful of Stars.
My name is Magnus Nilsson, and I'm the chef at a restaurant called Faviken Magasinet up north in Sweden.
Magnus Nilsson's Faviken is nestled in a small farm area in the middle of Sweden, near the Norwegian border. Faviken's allure comes from the creative use of traditional, locally foraged and preserved foods, presented as edible art. Magnus himself is Swedish, but he's taken on the whole of Scandinavia and beyond in his celebrated publication, The Nordic Cookbook. This isn't just any cookbook. The enormous tome illustrates, through stunning photos and hundreds of recipes, the way Nordic food traditions emerge from the cold, harsh climate that characterizes the region in winter and celebrates the long days of summer. So I understand that the publisher approaches you and wants you to write this book, and that you didn't really want to write this book.
No, I didn't, because I was kind of offended, because most people in the Nordic region, they don't identify themselves as being Nordic, nor do I, because I'm Swedish. And I felt it was a bit like taking some German and some Italian and some Portuguese and some French cooking and just putting that into a book and calling it sort of the European cookbook. But then I realized after kind of going back and forth a little bit that it was one of the main reasons why the book should actually exist, because almost no one knows what the Nordic region is. And if you don't even know that, you can't really know much about this food culture either.
Walk us through the great diversity that you found in your research and that we can find between the pages of the Nordic cookbook.
Well, you know, the region itself is vast and has a lot of different climates in it. And because of the, you know, its geographical size, you're also going to have a lot of different cultures kind of sharing this region. And it's not the Nordic regions as such is not a cultural region. It's just a geographical construction. So you have countries in it that up until quite recently in historical terms had very, very little contact with each other. You have Finland in the very east. And then in between Finland and Sweden, you're going to have a little island called Åland. You're going to have Sweden, Norway, Denmark, the Faroe Islands, Iceland and Greenland. And you can just imagine the difference, you know, from, let's say, southeastern parts of Finland, which borders on Russia, and then Greenland in the west.
Now, in the book, I'd like to know how you picked the recipes, because I have to say, I've never come across a cookbook that included recipes for seal, whale, and puffin.
To me, it was really important that this sort of became a document of like the real Nordic food culture as it looks today. Recipes like that, even though to me they're also very exotic because we don't eat any of those animals in Sweden, for example, but because they exist in other parts of the region and they're culturally significant in those parts, they kind of have to be included in the book. And I don't think that anyone is going to cook those recipes. But it doesn't really matter, you know, because the book has so many recipes. There are 730-something of them. And I actually counted, and I think that about 50 no one is ever going to cook for either that reason, you know, that you don't have the produce or because they are very, very complicated. And the important thing is that the remaining 600-something recipes, they are commonly used on a much broader front by more people in the region and they're more accessible. The one thing that's clear is that there's not a single recipe in the book that's mine, that I kind of made. They're all collected from other people in the region and people who cook them on an everyday basis.
I understand that a big part of the culture is flatbread.
Mm.
Does flatbread vary from place to place or is it all pretty much alike?
All breads vary quite a lot from place to place, like any other kind of food cultural expression. And what's interesting with the flatbread is that it's a true expression of, you know, the circumstances historically in the regions where they are produced. And in the Nordics, you can see, for example, that in the south, in the more urban areas, like from Stockholm and down south, you know, across Denmark and so on, it's more common with loaves of bread because they have dense enough population also in a historical perspective to have bakeries. Further up north, like where I grew up, we have today a population density of 1 person per square kilometer, meaning that you can't really have bakeries. Meaning that you have to produce bread that you can store for a long time because no one is going to fire up their baking oven on a daily basis just to bake bread for themselves. And this is kind of the idea with the flatbread. And most often they are actually dried.
And when they're dried, how long will they last like that?
Years. And after being baked in the wood-fired oven, you just stack them to dry and you leave them like that. And you can either just break pieces off and make a sandwich with it, or you can just sort of crumble it into a soup or into cultured milk or something like that.
I was very charmed by the concept that in these ovens where there's this hot, hot flat stone where the flatbreads are being baked, once a farm family will finish, they will invite their neighbors to come over and use their precious heat.
Yeah.
Tell me about that community experience.
That was how it actually really functioned in the villages, especially in Sweden in the old days, because all of the farms, they were located around the kind of core of the village. So everyone was pretty close together. So it was quite convenient if someone fired up their baking oven that instead of just sort of wasting the heat when you were done, you know, your neighbors and your neighbor's neighbors could come over and continue baking on the heat or adding a little bit of extra firewood and kind of just starting it all over again. And that has kind of disappeared a little bit. It still exists in some villages like mine where the farms are still located in roughly that pattern.
Take us to your little village. Let's like circle in on where you live today and talk about your restaurant, Flaviken. First of all, how long does it really take to get a reservation there?
So we release our reservations on the 1st of April, which is kind of a funny date to do that, but that's the one we've chosen. And it books out pretty quickly.
For the whole year?
Yeah. It's a set menu, and it's a tasting menu with many little bites, you know, to showcase as much of the food culture of the area as possible.
How many is the usual number?
Yeah, it's usually between 25 and 30 little things.
So the things that I saw that you've done that just blew me away, that process that you go through with colostrum. And for anybody who wouldn't know what that is, explain what that is, when you get it, and then what you do with it.
So colostrum is the first milk that any mammal gives after having given birth. And it's a very common traditional food, especially then harvested from cows in like most European countries, actually. That tradition has died out further south, but it's still, you know, very common up north in Scandinavia. And what you do is that the calf gets the first couple of milkings because they need that to, you know, basically kickstart their immune system and stuff like that.
Yes.
And then the third and fourth milking you harvest. And the colostrum is very different from normal milk because it has a extremely high protein content. So if you, for example, would take colostrum and pour it in a pan and, you know, put it on heat, it would stiffen like if it was eggs. And it's also very rich in flavor, and it's extremely tasty, actually. And traditionally, you make something called kalvdans, which is literally translates to calf's dance. And it's basically colostrum with a little bit of normal milk added to it and sugar, and you bake it like a custard in the oven to eat it with whipped cream or berries and something like that.
And is that something you had growing up?
Yes, definitely.
Now, just describe that magic trick that I've seen you do with colostrum, because it's just so artful to take something so traditional and then transform it.
Yeah, so what we did was to create, it looks almost like a little eggshell out of milk powder. And then we make basically like the traditional dessert, but we just mix it until it's a smooth kind of creamy custard, and we pipe that into the little shell. And then we add some berries and stuff into the shell again, and, you know, you just pick the whole thing up and you eat it in one bite.
Well, I'm so honored, and I really hope that sometime in this great big world our paths cross again. So thank you so much for making the time for us.
Thanks for having me. And please do come and visit sometime.
I'd love to.
Magnus Nielsen, chef at Faviken in Sweden and author of the Nordic Cookbook.
What's the traditional drink of Scandinavia? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Greetings. I'm Jake Abair.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left-field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM, KRVS.
Bring the peanut butter because I'm bringing the jam on the Zydeco Stomp. I'm Herman Fuselier reminding you that every Saturday it's you and me till 3 with the best in Zydeco blues and old school R&B on KRVS. The music's so good you want to get on your telephone and call somebody and tell them I'm jamming with the Zydeco Stomp. Noon Saturdays only on KRVS. Lafayette, Lake Charles. Et toi, Moncle Pasha.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold.
Thank you.
week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What's the traditional drink of Scandinavia? The answer is aquavit, something you've probably never tasted unless you visited there. Aquavit comes from the Latin aquavitae, which translates water of life. It's a high-proof, clear liquor, much like vodka, that's distilled from either potatoes or grain. Aquavit is flavored with caraway, cardamom, cumin, anise, fennel, and dill, with caraway being the most outstanding taste. Some drink it cold, some at room temperature. Some drink it out of shot glasses, and some out of little stemmed tulip glasses. But everyone in Scandinavia drinks aquavit, especially at weddings and other celebrations. Oh, and of course, at crawfish boils. Yes, in Finland and Sweden, during late July and early August, it's the preferred drink with boiled crawfish, along with plenty of beer and schnapps. The traditional toast is skål. So, skål, y'all! I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. The legendary Julia Child once said, "Find something you're passionate about and keep tremendously interested in it." When Chef Rick Bayless earned the Julia Child Award in 2016 for his transformative Mexican cuisine, he brought Julia's idea to life. Rick is the James Beard Award-winning chef and owner of several authentic yet trend-setting Mexican restaurants in Chicago, and hosts his own public television series, Mexico, One Plate at a Time. Despite all of these accomplishments, Rick approaches cooking with remarkable humility, something that was clearly evident during his visit to our studio.
Julia Child came on television when I was 10, and she changed my life. Because even as a 10-year-old that was really interested in food and cooking, which was kind of unusual back then because we didn't have the Food Network to sort of goad us along, I fell in love with the ideas that she presented. She was just such an amazing teacher, and she would talk about where you would eat these different dishes in France and how they were prepared and the care that went into all of their preparation. And for me, that was a really eye-opening experience. So I spent a lot of time in my home kitchen mastering the art of French cooking, as Julia's first book was called. I actually got that book when I was 12. That's another really long story, is how a 12-year-old comes up on a big tome like that. But I cooked all the way through it. I made all those dishes that were in it. And then when I was 13, I came to New Orleans and had those wonderful experiences here in the restaurants, and that was so different than what we had in Oklahoma City. And so I was able to put it all together, and I figured that I was probably going to really focus on French cooking because I was just in love with the refinement of it, the traditions of it, the variety that you could find there. And then the next year, I had the opportunity to go to Mexico City, and that changed my life because I didn't fall in love with the food first. I fell in love with the culture and the generosity of spirit. And I tell you, when I got off of the plane, I was there about an hour and I felt like I'd come home, that something about that culture was just perfect for me, and sort of settled into going back every year, then majored in Spanish language, literature, and Latin American studies. And then the rest is kind of history. I moved there for a long time, decided to put my love for food together with my love for Mexican culture, and wrote my first book. And then after 5 years, moved back to the States and opened our first restaurant, Frontera Grill, which is now turning 30 years old. So I'm getting up on the tails of what my parents did with their restaurant for 37 years.
Incredible. And to have this complete circle, I cannot imagine the incredible, humbling overwhelming honor it must have been when you discovered that they were going to award you the Julia Child Award.
I kind of sat down and cried because it was one of those things that was full circle. If it weren't for Julia opening my eyes to the possibilities of the food world, I wouldn't be where I am now.
So explain for people who may not know what comes with receiving the Julia Child Award.
It's a really wonderful thing. First of all, it's part of the Smithsonian, and the organization is what they're really looking for is people who have made a big impact in the way that people eat and drink in the United States. And I've plodded along for all these years, opening people's eyes, I hope, to the riches of Mexican food and its culture. And I've done a lot of it through teaching, especially on my television show, and a lot of writing. And then, of course, actually backing it up with restaurants that serve this kind of food, because we don't know very much about it, still don't know that much about it in the United States, so we're getting a lot better. And when they picked me to do that, they announced that it was going to be a $50,000 prize to go to the charity of my choice. And my charity is the Frontera Farmer Foundation, which is a not-for-profit that we started about 12 years ago to support local agriculture. Because what I had learned in Mexico was that the best food comes from the places that have the best local agriculture. And we were really not doing well in Chicago 30 years ago when I set up shop there. We didn't have a single farmer's market. I couldn't find a single local farm to buy from. I could drive for an hour and a half outside the city and buy stuff from a farm stand, but that wasn't very sustainable. And then over the 30 years, we have changed really drastically, and a lot because we have helped to invest in these farms. So we invest small, they're really small grants, usually $10,000 to $12,000 to help people buy a tractor, a watering system, a new hoop house, whatever they say that they need to make themselves more productive and profitable, that's what we will invest in. And we've given away about $1.5 million in these small grants, and it's really made a big difference. Now we have like 40-some farmers markets in Chicago and a really thriving chef community that buys from the local farms.
It's really exciting. And to me, the most amazing and inspirational part is your tortilla program.
Oh, yeah. So we buy mostly, like all of our proteins are all locally raised around Chicago. Of course, we'll put some fish from the two coasts on the menu. We don't only work with lake fish that come from around us. This corn program, well, a lot of people don't even know this, that a whole lot of the corn that is made into this masa flour by a big company called Maseca in Mexico is grown in the Midwest. And the second largest Maseca plant in the world is just south of Chicago. And they are growing all this Midwest corn, and it's all GMO corn, and then they're making this Maseca out of it and then shipping it back to Mexico. And it is engineered to be as flavorless as possible so that no matter what region of Mexico you are in, it's not competing with your local stuff. It's just a blank slate. And now people have gotten so used to that, they've almost forgotten what really good regional varieties of heirloom corn taste like. So to counteract that, we decided we were going to work with a group called Macienda, and we were going to bring in truckloads and truckloads of corn that is grown by small family farms in Oaxaca and have that made into our masa every day, our fresh masa, by a tortilleria in Chicago that does all non-GMO corn anyway. And the first day, this is a real telling thing. It was like every single person on our staff that grew up in Mexico had to stop and just smell it. And it was like you could tell that they were a million miles away, back in time to their childhood when they were maybe at their grandmother's house and back when the corn was still really good in Mexico. And they would smell it and they would go, oh, this is like my childhood. This is like all the memories that are flooding into my head just smelling this corn. It is so delicious.
You must have wanted to cry that day, too.
It was incredibly rewarding because I have spent a lot of time. I lived in Oaxaca for a while, and I knew what that flavor was like. And I loved the tortillas that we hand-pressed and made for all of these years in our restaurant. In fact, the reason we settled in Chicago is that there's such great availability of masa, fresh ground masa in Chicago. And I built our restaurant on these hand-pressed tortillas that are always taken from the griddle straight to your table. Those are what, to me, are the foundation of all flavor. If you eat that tortilla alongside a super flavorful mole, say, they're balancing each other because the simplicity of the flavor in the tortilla balances so beautifully against the complexity of that mole. And it's the balance that's happened and been created over many centuries. And I respect that.
Well, you are just like meeting a live wire in person. I mean, my goodness, there's the restaurants, but your PBS television show is going into its 11th season.
11th season, if you can imagine. Yes, we just finished it.
How do you keep creating?
You know, I'm incredibly curious. That's all. I will say that a lot of it just has to do with curiosity. As I was walking around, I mean, here we are in the middle of the French Quarter. Even though there's all these touristy shops, I found myself wandering into some of them and looking at some of the ingredients and wondering what's the history of this thing that they're selling here. And I'm just really interested in digging below the surface and finding all the riches because I love the human race. We make things beautiful. We don't have to. You know, we could nourish ourselves on unseasoned gruel. Okay, we could. We don't have to make beautifully presented food. We don't have to make delicious food. We don't have to make beautiful clothing and gorgeous architecture. We do that because in our souls we want the joy of seeing beauty. And I'm one of those people that just loves to explore what people have done that's really beautiful. And I respect it and I love it, and I am infinitely curious to what leads people to create this beauty when they don't have to. I mean, we could all be sitting in front of the TV with our feet up and doing nothing, but instead we choose to tackle these projects because we create beauty in the world.
Chef Rick Bayless of Chicago's Frontera Restaurants. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Palace Cafe, home of the Weekend Jazz Brunch, featuring a build-your-own Bloody Mary bar, located in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.
Hi there, this is Lee Klein-Peter with an invite to join me for Barn on the Bayou, Saturday afternoons at 3 on KRVS.